Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, the rising price of gold and what it may mean for artisanal miners scratching for a living.
Some people, 10, 15, 25, have gone. They have died.
You've heard about people who have died?
Yes.
Are you afraid?
I'm afraid, but there's no work for me to do. What can I do? I can't do anything.
Also in the show, we have a lot more looking at the rising prices of lithium and how it's affecting Serbia. And we hear from the central bank governor of Bangladesh, who's fresh into a new job there. Now, what is happening to the global gold market at the moment? Western investors have piled back into the prized commodity ahead of expected interest rate cuts in the United States later this year. That's helped to drive prices to record highs this week, over $2,500 per ounce, making a bar of gold an ingot worth more than $1 million. Now, gold has always been seen as a safe haven to some at a time of economic weakness. So does that in fact mean we should be worried about the state of the global economy? What's really driving this demand? Jordan Roy Byrne, the editor and publisher of thedailygold.com, is with me now. Hi, Jordan. What is behind the latest spike, would you say, in general terms?
Well, I think you said it there in your intro. In the very short term, in the immediate sense, the market is discounting the almost near certainty, you could say, that the Federal Reserve next month is going to start cutting interest rates. And historically, if you look back at gold in its history, the number one driver is negative or falling real interest rates. So with the U.S. economy weakening, and the Federal Reserve having room to cut interest rates, the market is now discounting the fact that real interest rates are going to move lower. So that's going to benefit gold. Now, before where we are presently, there have been other factors driving gold. But here and now, we're getting it back to the main factor. That's the driver.
Okay. So essentially, you've got a rich Western investor. They've stuck their money. They've parked their spare cash, so to speak, in things like the bond market because there are high interest rates, high yields there. And that's coming down, so they're looking for somewhere else to park their money. They're going to risk it on gold, even though it doesn't deliver a yield perhaps in the same way. It's a good, strong banking bet because everyone believes it's a safe haven at a time of let's just say, lower returns elsewhere.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And yes, go ahead.
And the other point that you were driving at, is it that what's happening with the smaller countries of the world, do they want gold in their vaults, so to speak, as an alternative to the dollar?
Yes, that is also a big driver. You know, it's kind of a non-traditional driver. And so that's what has been driving the market up until very recently, I would say, as far as the main driver. So central bank demand in other countries looking to diversify their reserves, you know, away from U.S. treasuries, away from the dollar. That has been a big driver recently, and there's a lot of room for that to continue.
It's odd, isn't it? Because it's not really a functioning thing. It's just something that people have because people think that other people want it. It's a bit like Bitcoin, perhaps, some would argue. But it doesn't have a use. I mean, where is the main gold market for people who actually use the stuff?
Well, the industrial use of gold is very, very little, which makes it unique to other commodities. I mean, historically, gold has been money dating back for hundreds of years. So that's really the main driver of its value. As far as uses, I mean, there's some technological and industrial uses. I mean, gold teeth, for example. But it's really looked at as money if you're getting down to like the real root of it.
And the wedding season in India, perhaps.
Correct, correct. Yes, jewelry demand is very big in India and China as well.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Jordan Roybern of thedailygold.com. So that's the price of gold and why it's in such demand at the moment. But of course, at times of rising prices, that creates opportunities for all kinds of people hoping to cash in. A report this year suggested that as much as $35 billion worth of gold produced by artisanal and small-scale mining in Africa alone goes undeclared. The gold is being smuggled out, most of it to dealers in places like the Gulf. Africa is the world's top bullion producing continent. And Ghana is just about its most gold-rich country. A few years ago, I met a group of poor illegal miners in Ghana working an open-pit mine in blazing heat and in what were often very dangerous conditions.
We dig it for ourselves so that we can cater for ourselves and then our family. That's why we are doing this work.
It's not illegal. It belongs to the community. If you say we should stop this work, where are we going? Should we go and be rebels? Should we go and rob? Should we go and steal? We can't do anything like that. That is why we are suffering with our hands, with our strength, to provide for ourselves and our family.
It belongs to our forefathers. Our forefathers have died, and we are the next generation. This land is not illegal. It's for our grandfathers, and we are working on it.
You can hear some people, 10, 15, 25, have gone. They have died.
You've heard about people who have died?
Yes, yes.
Friends of yours?
Yes.
Are you afraid?
By now, I'm afraid, but there's no work for me to do. What can I do? I can't do anything. But only God protect us. A human being cannot protect us. Only God.
Miners speaking to me in the Obuasi region there of Ghana a few years ago. Well, Brazil is another country where illegal gold mining has become increasingly a way of life. Larissa Rodriguez is a mining expert. She's a research director at the Instituto Escolhas, which is a think tank dedicated to the economy and sustainability research in Sao Paulo. Hi, Larissa. What is the scale then of illegal mining in Brazil, would you say, right now?
Yes, so illegal mining in Brazil is a huge problem because our studies point that more than half of Brazil's gold production has a strong sign of being illegal. And most of it, when you talk about illegal mining in Brazil, you're talking about the Amazon rainforest region. That's where most of the small-scale operations are, and that's where we do have a lot of illegal operations going on, especially inside indigenous lands and other environmental protected areas.
And what are the impacts of so much illegal mining on the people who do it and on the environment there?
Yeah, the impact is very severe, and one of them is the mercury contamination, because in Brazil, we do still use a lot of mercury, and also mercury, most of the mercury market in Brazil is also illegal, not only the gold, but mercury as well. So we are talking about millions of people, thousands of people contaminated with mercury in Brazil, but we don't have
just to be clear,
figures.
You're using the mercury to refine the ore to make the gold, right? Once you've dug out the nugget, you're using the mercury to heat up the gold to extract the purer form of it.
Exactly. That's correct. So, and normally mercury is used not by industrial mining, but by the small scale operations. So, and normally, as I said, these operations are in the Amazon rainforest and they're very close to rivers or sometimes inside the rivers. So we are talking about the human contamination, but also the rivers and fishes. And there is, it's a big chain of mercury contamination.
Is it your impression that this whole trade is getting much more extreme, more rife, more widespread as a result of this high gold price we've been hearing about, the fact that it's now 20, 30% higher than it was just a few months ago?
Yes, absolutely. Because as operations are illegal here, of course, when you have the gold price is so high, it pays off the risk of the operation. So it's worth it. It is still worth it to mine illegally because the price is so high.
And
so we do Okay. We do see a lot of increase in operations here.
And briefly, is President Lula doing anything about it? I mean, he's credited with clamping down on the speed of deforestation, isn't he? What is the government doing about the illegal mining specifically?
Yes, I have to say that the government in Brazil is doing a lot of things. So especially last year, the government implemented a lot of new rules, like to control the gold market. So we have more oversight, and we can maybe stop the market, the illegal market in the future. But the thing is, there is still a long way to go, especially because the gold demand is still very high.
Right.
So even with controls, with better controls that we have now, there is still a big market for gold smugglers.
Larissa Rodriguez in Sao Paulo, thank you very much indeed. Well, joining us now is Susan Schmidt. She's head of public equity at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. Hi, Susan. The gold price looks like, actually, there was some profit taking today, wasn't there? And the price came down a little bit. It was moderated. But generally, it's been a pretty strong day on the markets.
Gold price moderated today, but ever so slightly. And overall, the trend for gold has been up and to the right. So it's been advancing in value. The dollar softened slightly and has been weakening against most other currencies. And so that usually also indicates that gold is likely strengthening as an offset to that when the dollar price is going down. So, but overall, tremendous strength in gold as an asset class in the recent months.
Now, as we've already touched on, all eyes are on the Fed. They're always on the Fed, aren't they? Steaming towards a September rate cut, everybody thinks, according to these latest minutes that have been revealed today.
That's right. So investors are reassured by the minutes because the message hasn't changed. And when they read through those minutes and get into the details, they do see that several governors are in favor of considering a rate cut. And as soon as the September meeting, market expectation now is that when we get to that September meeting, we will see a decline from the Fed in interest rates. And the market anticipates that's going to be a decline of 0.25%.
Ford Motor Company, that is. What on earth is happening there? They're ditching their EV, their electric vehicle SUV. There all kinds of changes at Ford, which seems strange, I don't know, to an outsider, because we were all imagining the transition was big. And indeed, the Ford EV seemed like the SUV seemed like a big offering.
It did seem like a big offering, and Ford certainly made a big deal about it as they considered this and started to shift into that. Now they've made a big deal about moving away from it to a certain extent. They don't want to place such a big bet on that, with the CEO coming out and saying they really need to look at it, analyze it, and if they lean in that direction, they want to make sure they're going the right way. This is largely prompted, I believe, by the underperformance of Ford's share price year to date. And clearly, they've been having problems. It hasn't been rewarded, this move to EVs, by the market. And I think Ford management is really trying to make sure they're on the right track strategically and with operating margins and profitability to make sure that they can manage a decent return to shareholders.
Okay, Susan Schmidt, thank you very much.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Indeed. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, it's just a month since Sheikh Hasina, the long-standing premier of Bangladesh, was forced into exile after increasingly vociferous nationwide protests there. It's just 2 weeks since the Nobel Prize-winning economist Muhammad Yunus was sworn in as head of a new interim government to replace her. He, in turn, has appointed a former IMF economist, whose name is Asan Mansour, to serve as the central bank governor. That's a big challenge in a country that's now facing runaway inflation and a teetering bank solvency situation. In his first broadcast interview since taking the job, Dr. Mansour has been speaking to our BBC business correspondent, Nikhil Ananda. I spoke to Nikhil a couple of hours ago. I asked him to describe the types of problems afflicting the Bangladeshi economy at the moment.
So I think what I would say is that the economy seems to be limping back, but there are no easy fixes over here because this economy has been impacted right since COVID, when remittances, which are a big part of the economy, were hit. Garments, which are a mainstay of Bangladeshi exports, they contribute to something like 80% of exports. They went down during COVID. That led to a depreciation in the currency, which led to high inflation. And these are some of the problems that the economy has been confronting for a very long time now. And I think the recent crisis that we saw, the shutdowns, the internet blackouts, all of that only contributed to worsening the state of the economy and also the business sector. So I've been speaking to some garment owners who say that they've reopened now, but it will take some time for them to get back to any degree of normalcy.
So you've now been talking to the central bank governor, Ehsan Mansour. This is his first broadcast interview, I believe, since he took over this job as a part of the new government. What's he been saying about high inflation?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is an exclusive interview that he did give to the BBC this evening here in Dhaka. And what he essentially said was that taming runaway inflation was his big priority at this point in time. And even though the economy was a bit derailed, he said that interest rates will have to go up because inflation is a bigger monster. So just take a listen in, Ted, to what he had to say.
Rising interest rate is not a pleasant thing. I don't want it. But I feel inflation, high inflation, is worse enemy than high interest rate. So we have to choose between the two evils. And I want to kill with one evil the other one. And hopefully, if inflation comes down to 5-6%, we'll bring down the interest rate thereafter.
That's Ehsan Mansour, the central bank governor of Bangladesh. Nikhil, one of the other issues he's raised has been this fear of the banks actually being at risk themselves. What was going on here?
Well, that's right. You know, banks in Bangladesh have in recent months or years rather been plagued by growing non-performing loans, very low liquidity as well, which means that they don't have enough money to give out credit. There's a sense that powerful businessmen who were close to the previous government are said to be some of the big willful defaulters because they were essentially given out loans quite indiscriminately. Even the central bank was printing money and giving out loans to people without any sort of collateral. So there was a great amount of corruption in the banking system. In fact, Dr. Mansour described what was happening as designed robbery of the financial system. And he went on to emphasize how really reforming the banks is going to be his key priority and asked him how he was planning to do that.
We'll have to reconstruct the banking system. So we are trying to establish a banking commission and work out program which will involve change of board, change of management, change of injection of capital, new owners being brought in, and in some cases small banks, merge them together.
So will it be a full nationalization of some of the banks?
For Islamic Bank, initially it will be virtual nationalization of the banks, yes.
The thoughts there of the central bank governor. Nikhil, do you feel that the new government of Muhammad Yunus still has the confidence of the people in this very volatile period?
It's quite interesting that in this country that's been ruled by two parties, Dr. Muhammad would sort of come in and stand in as the advisor of the interim government. And I think, you know, that just talks of his international standing. I think it talks of the kind of reputation he has among global investors. And at this point in time, the sense that I get here in Bangladesh is that people are very keen to repair an image of an economy that's been broken by autocracy, by corruption. And they feel that the image that Dr. Yunus brings with him, the global equity that he brings with him, will add to the much needed stability currency at this point in time in the country. Of course, it's an interim government, but it's very unclear at this point in time when the next elections will be held. Dr. Yunus has been holding some sort of meetings with diplomats in the last week where he indicated that he will stay on till there is a comprehensive reform of Bangladesh's judicial, political and economic institutions. And that could take many years. So when the next elections will be held is a big question mark right now.
The BBC's Nikhil Inamdar speaking to me from Dhaka. Now, protests have become a feature of the last few weeks in Serbia ever since Belgrade reinstated the license of a mining firm there to develop what would be Europe's biggest lithium mine. The $2.4 billion Jadar lithium mine is set to cover 90% of Europe's current lithium needs. It would make Rio Tinto one of the world's leading lithium producers. I've been speaking about the scale and significance of the deal with Andrei Kovatariu. He's an energy expert with the ESSERA think tank in Brussels.
The European Union is trying to advance its decarbonization agenda, started years ago, but at the same time, it's trying to ensure its security of supply, its energy security, by looking into alternative energy options. Clean technologies, including batteries, play a vital role. And the manufacturing of batteries and the whole structure of battery-based solutions depends on lithium.
The problem here is that lithium is only found in certain parts of the world, and Europe is competing with China and other places where they make electric cars, and they have a large proportion of the global supply of lithium, don't they, for these batteries?
Absolutely. China has a head start in that. It has developed its mining and refining processes and sectors over the past decades. So now, obviously, Europe is trying to look into alternative solutions in order to de-risk, basically, its supply needs from China. The Serbian area is quite vast, and it's a bit more advanced than some other countries in the European Union.
I mean, this is the biggest in Europe, isn't it, of its kind?
It's among the biggest reserves that we know in the European space.
Just very simply, how much lithium are they claiming is in the Serbian prospect?
So they are talking about approximately 58,000 tons of lithium a year. The mining operation would be functional from 2028, and that could bring 15 to 20, depends on how we look at the numbers, 15 to 20% of the European EV needs by 2030. So it's quite substantial.
They're talking about more than a million cars here, aren't they?
Yes, 1.1 million cars per year, approximately. That would be the equivalent of the lithium reserves that Serbia claims to have on the ground.
So a big deal, as Andrei Kovatariu says. Nonetheless, as also mentioned, the project is controversial. Yep, there have been numerous demonstrations, just like this one, over recent weeks across Serbia since the deal was reconfirmed by the government there with the mine company. Protesters are angry about the environmental damage to a fragile local water supply, about the forced seizure of people's homes, and now also about what is alleged to be the targeting by police of as many as 40 local activists who want to stop the project. One of them is Alexander Matkovic. He's an economist, and he's been telling me what happened to him when he published a letter outlining what he said were the economic weaknesses of the lithium deal.
Well, basically, on 10th of August, I published a very short economic text in an oppositional newspaper daily called Danas. And there I outlined that in the last 5 years, investment in mining has not translated into the rise of living standards and increase of dangerous waste. As a consequence, there are not that many benefits. That was the entire point of the text. 4 days after I published the letter, I received a message saying, "We will follow you until you disappear." .com. So the day after, so I was outside of Serbia, so I was in another country, and I received another message saying, asking me, "How's the Rio Tinto struggle going?" Only this time, the message in the Telegram application was displaying that the sender was located 500 meters from me. So that's when I thought, like, okay, what the hell is this? That's when I thought maybe this is something, like, not a joke.
How many of these messages did you get?
About 13 in total, that I should be afraid for my life and for the life of my younger brother. That if I want to continue to breathe and right. I should lay low and keep away from the public, and that I need to take this seriously, and I'm not taking this seriously. I reported this to the police.
Have other protesters also had threats like this?
Up until that point, no. I know at least 10 people who have been either arrested or their homes have been raided. So probably the worst situation was with a friend of mine from a nearby town. So she shared like a support letter for me. And her home was raided by the Serbian internal security agencies, even though she's 5 months into her pregnancy.
How did the police respond to your complaints?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, when the media asked them if the report is being processed, they actually denied the existence of the report. So they said that I hadn't submitted anything. Only after the media attention, I was called and I was told that the police has started to process the report and no new information came out since then.
Going back to the main problem, the campaign to stop the mine, how do you think this will resolve? Do you think the protests will make any difference?
To be honest, I think without a long-term strategy, any protest is like problematic. The specific thing here is that President Vucic is in a very sensitive position because he has contracts with German companies and the EU. He has to deliver on something. This puts him in a position where he has already exhausted all the ideological and all the manipulative strategies he had, you know, calling us foreign agents and whatnot. It's very hard to do anything in this situation apart from using police violence without any sort of party opposition, an alternative proposal for the mine. But I think that the people who are opposing them now will definitely oppose them in the future. And this is a momentum that will be returning to Vucic time and time again. Serbia will probably be very volatile when it comes to lithium.
That's Aleksandar Matković. Serbian officials deny that they've been targeting or harassing activists. They say that the lithium mine would boost the Balkan economy's country by creating some 20,000 jobs. Now, a final thought on the EU-China tensions we've been hearing about this week. On Tuesday, it was about cars being exported from China to the European Union. Now it's about dairy products going the other way. It's all part of the same story. The trade spat appears to be deepening. In the latest move, the Chinese government said it's opening an investigation into European dairy products to see if they're being unfairly subsidised. Ireland is by far the biggest exporter of dairy products to China. Dennis Drennan, the president of the Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association, told us how it's going to affect him.
Unfortunately, we have a huge market in China. It's about half a billion, mainly of infant formula that we send to China because there's a huge demand out there for sustainable, nutritious, grass-fed infant formula for their children. We've about 30% of the world market. And it's looking likely, now not definitely confirmed yet, but there will be a tariff going on that. And me as a farmer in rural Ireland is going to get caught up in something that's certainly nothing to do with me. And I can't have any influence over the price of my milk is going to suffer because of this international trade war.
A beleaguered Irish farmer there. And that's it for World Business Report. Thanks for listening.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather. And there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.